Welcome, good evening. This weekend I was at a retreat in New Mexico on Dzogchen and Zen. So I'd like to give a report from the front lines tonight. I think this is kind of a cutting edge topic. I think it's maybe the first of its kind. A Zen teacher and a Tibetan Dzogchen teacher coming together and comparing and teaching from their unique traditions. I went to this retreat because many of you know that I'm very drawn to the Tibetan Dzogchen teachings and practice. Dzogchen means great perfection. And this style of meditation has seemed to me for some time now to be virtually identical to what we call just sitting, shikantaza, in Zen. But they have many ways of talking about the subtleties of it in the Tibetan tradition. It's very refreshing for me, and it's been very helpful to my practice, practicing with teachers in that tradition for these and other conditions known and unknown. That's where my practice emphasis is often going these days, towards those particular teachings as well as Zen. And this teacher, Sokne Rinpoche, who co-led the retreat with Roshi Joan Halifax, I consider him my root Tibetan teacher. I've done quite a few retreats with him and other teachers too, but Sokne Rinpoche in particular, I feel a strong karmic affinity with. And really appreciate his style of presenting the practice, and he has a great sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And he was born with the same year as me too. So I feel like we've shared this path on Earth for the same time. So though I've seen the similarity a lot between Dzogchen and Zen, when I saw this retreat being offered, I thought, wow, somebody else picked up on it and is going to talk about this too, so I couldn't resist going. This was at Upaya Zen Center, Roshi Joan Halifax, Roshi Joan as they call her there. Her thriving and very inspiring Zen Center in Santa Fe, New Mexico. For those who haven't been to that area, it's like all the houses and buildings, even like Safeway, everything's built in this adobe style with flat roofs and either fake or real, you know, adobe with thick walls. So of course they built the Zen Center in that style. A wonderful blend of kind of like Japanese and Native American kind of architecture. Beautiful, beautiful temple and grounds. I think they have some, I got the sense there that there's some connection with San Francisco Zen Center. I think it's one of the larger centers in that part of the country, and that there just aren't so many large Zen centers in America, I think is maybe what it comes down to. But there were several people I met there who I knew from Tassajara, and we're living there, and most of the residents seem like have practiced, actually lived at San Francisco Zen Center. So there's this circulation through the American Zen world, it seems, that was you know, I hadn't been out there before, so that was very refreshing to see too. And Roshi Joan Halifax is, I hadn't met her before, so it was great to connect with her and get to talk some. She's in her 70s now, the abbot there, and very active practitioner in many different areas. And her past is practice is very interesting, starting with psychedelic research with death and dying. She was married to Stan Grof, who might know him through holotropic breath work, and then got into Zen with Sungsan Sunim, the great Korean Zen teacher. She practiced with Thich Nhat Hanh and was entrusted as a teacher by Thich Nhat Hanh, and she's the Dharma heir of Roshi Bernie Glassman in the Maizumi Roshi Soto Zen lineage. And very interested in kind of brain science, these mind and life conferences with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, she's very involved in, and engagement with the world, still working with dying, compassionate care for dying people. So Upaya Zen Center is, she calls it a large roof. And this is very inspiring to me to see that, although maybe smaller Zen Center than San Francisco, I think larger roof in the sense that many different traditions. She has really great teachers from quite a few from Tibetan tradition, Vipassana, scholars and yogis, a lot of brain science people, and as well as arts and many Zen teachers, including like Alan Sanaki, other San Francisco, Norman Fisher, Roshi is quite active there, Kaz Tanahashi, active there. They're very good friends. Lots of Kaz calligraphy around that place. So the title of this retreat was Dzogchen and Zen, Exploring the Direct Experience of Mind, which is, I think, what these traditions are about in their essence. We sometimes chant Dogen's lines, in the authentic tradition of our teaching, it is said that this directly transmitted, straightforward Buddha Dharma is the unsurpassable of the unsurpassable. And Dzogchen tradition has many sayings like that too. Dogen goes on to say, just wholeheartedly sit and thus drop off body and mind. So it's these types of teachings about non-dual nature of mind that these traditions are exploring. So both of the teachers taught on and off, and there was one particular meeting where there was really like kind of a comparison of the two traditions with question and answer. So I thought maybe I'd just bring up some of those points they touched on. Yeah. Roshi Joan mentioned something like, it seems to her that both of these traditions, and she's actually practiced quite a lot in the Tibetan tradition too, with various teachers, so she has some sense of that. And she said they both seem to be about ordinary mind and ordinariness, as opposed to reaching some exalted, magnificent Buddhahood. Maybe we could say it's an exalted, magnificent Buddhahood, but it manifests as ordinariness. Both traditions emphasize that. Ordinary mind is the way. The great teachers in both traditions often seem to be quite ordinary, but quite open. And Sogni Rinpoche talked about some of his old Tibetan teachers that seem very ordinary when you're talking to them, but then if you hang out for a while or kind of look into their eyes, you don't kind of see anything behind their eyes. Like there's not somebody there, like a kind of a strong identity that's coming forward. They're ordinary and yet can't pin them down. Something like that. There's no fixation in the background. And, you know, I think different Tibetan teachers will say different things. Everybody within their own tradition often praises their own tradition as the ultimate. Maybe in all kinds of religion and spirituality, it's very hard to not do that at least in a little way, because we choose the practice that we choose because hopefully we feel like it's the best, at least for us. So I've heard, because I've been interested in this topic for a while, various Tibetan teachers I've talked to say, sometimes they say, you know, Zen's not quite as ultimate as the Dzogchen tradition. So I was very happy to hear Soken Rinpoche, who said he's actually read quite a bit of Dogen himself in the modern world, where these traditions mix, and he feels like once there's some understanding of the practice, that Zen and Dzogchen are exactly identical. It's just that the methods to reach this deep understanding or realization are a little bit different. Even the methods are quite similar, but a little different. But that mind that one rests in the end, is how could it be different? So some of the comparison was, on the surface, it looks like aesthetically these traditions are very different, right? Zen, very, very simple, sparse. Some of us were talking today about, we don't have any artwork on the walls. It's kind of usual for a Zendo. There's nothing there. Very simple decor. And it was proposed by these teachers that, well, maybe it's because Japan is this small island, it's very crowded and a lot going on there, and so you could keep a very simple Zendo. Whereas Tibet, the landscape is this vast expanse of like desert plain with nothing on it, so the temples are very elaborate and colorful, as you may have seen. Like every inch of the wall is covered with paintings, often. So that's one difference, a little style in the aesthetics. So Sogyi Rinpoche said he was in Japan recently and visited some Zen temples and just really loved to be in that space where there's nothing around, that he couldn't leave for like hours just sitting there. His attendant with him, are you going to go yet? And he said, are you enjoying this? Like, that nothing's here? Also, it was brought up that by Roshi Joan, that Zen, at least traditionally, the teachings on kindness, compassion, and bodhicitta, this, you know, arousing the great wish for awakening for the benefit of all beings. These are implicit in the Zen tradition, but not explicit. And I think in modern American Zen, they're becoming more explicit. I think we actually talk a lot about kindness and compassion, and we bring in early Buddhist teachings about that, and maybe Tibetan teachings, where they emphasize these qualities a lot. But if you look to the classic Zen texts, like Dogen, you find a little of it, but it's not the emphasis. And I like how she put it, that it's implicit. It is there, and the more you drop off body and mind, the more your compassion and kindness naturally come forth. Both traditions actually say that. It's just that the Tibetan tradition emphasizes, right from the start, you're cultivating, intentionally cultivating, kindness and compassion. Another thing, difference, and something that Zen doesn't emphasize much is the subtle body. And Soken Rinpoche, this teacher in particular, it's one of his current emphases. So I think in Zen, the things that do, or the way we have it a little bit, is when we talk about the hara or the tanden, the dantian, in qigong and tai chi and martial arts and so on. This is mentioned a lot, this energy center of the body. And you can find it in Chinese and Japanese Zen teachings, but not very much. And there's not much teaching about what to do about it, except in general, breathe from down here, which is the basic teaching, the very basic teaching in the Tibetan tradition too. It's just more, there's more working with the subtle body, means like the chi or prana and the channels to which it flows. And Soken Rinpoche, who mostly teaches Westerners around the world, he more and more is emphasizing the practices to balance the subtle body, which are in Tibetan tradition considered kind of advanced practices. You don't usually start with it, but he feels like in the modern Western world, everything is really speedy. Life is speedy and complicated and digitized, and we need ways of like deeply relaxing and balancing our energy. And I feel this is very true myself. I've been working with these types of practices in the last year or so. I actually practiced with a Kundalini yoga teacher. I think that these Tibetan teachings are based on Indian Kundalini, which is moving the subtle energy through the body, and very much integrated with mind. There's the gross body, then the mind, and kind of in between them is the subtle energy body. And Soken Rinpoche brings these teachings out in a kind of in a very simple way that anyone can access. That's just basically like bringing your breath down, breathing deeply, deeply relaxing. And this is I know there are other forms of Kundalini yoga that are maybe more forceful and different yogic practices. The teacher I'm working with also emphasizes deep relaxation. Really, really, that's what it's basically about. Especially in the lower abdomen, any kind of muscle tension there, bring your energy and your breath down and deeply relax that area. And Soken Rinpoche says, when your energy's residing in its home there, there's a natural feeling of well-being, almost like a mood or emotion, but that's not connected to anything that's happening externally. And what he calls happiness for no reason, like a basic sense of well-being. And I think we often don't have that. I notice in my own life when I'm kind of get like, I'm not really practicing with that so much, and I'm getting kind of like too busy. Even this, you know, traveling a lot on this weekend, I felt this happening some, is that there's not a sense of general well-being, you know? It's kind of like, you know, I feel more tired and scattered and maybe even more irritable. But when things are balanced down here, it's not that hard to do. It just takes putting the time and attention, bringing the energy down, and any kind of qigong practices are also good for this. Happiness for no reason. So I appreciate that in the Dzogchen tradition, that we don't have so much in Zen. Also in Tibetan tradition, there's what they're called the preliminary practices, nundro, which I think in Zen, again, maybe we could say implicit but not explicit. We have lots of what we call like relative practices. If this, you know, resting in the nature of mind is like the ultimate practice, or shikantaza is just this non-doing, We also have lots of practices of doing in Zen. Like all our ritual practices are actually, have the same elements as these Tibetan preliminary practices. But traditionally, in all the Tibetan Vajrayana lineages, they all have these same preliminary practices. Before, traditionally anyway, it's before the teacher points out the nature of mind, the non-dual nature of mind. One's really grounded in these like relative kind of doing practices, devotional practices, and just to briefly mention them in case you haven't heard this, they're taking refuge in Buddha and over, arousing bodhicitta, and these two are often combined with prostrations. So you, as you, one way to do it is you go, as you go down prostrating, you silently or out loud recite, "I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha," and as you come up, vowing to realize awakening to benefit all beings. So 100,000 times, which if you're like doing it full time in a retreat, could be done like in a half a year or something if you're doing, you know, I try to do like, do this kind of practice like 100 a day, and I'm on my third year now. I'm just going through these prostrations. But I feel like it's the emphasis is on, refuge is on surrender, and bodhicitta, arousing this wish to completely awaken, to completely benefit all, is the compassion aspect, is emphasizing openness and compassion. Surrender, if it's done wholeheartedly, deeply surrender, and then open and heart of compassion for all beings. Deeply surrender, drop off this small little self, rise up with open compassion for all. So it's a training, it's a mind training. It's a doing practice. It's not something that naturally arises. It's effortful practice. So a lot of people are drawn to the Dzogchen and want to just rest in the nature of mind, but when it comes to 100,000 prostrations, it's like, well, that seems like a kind of like extra, you know, if you have this ultimate practice, why do this conventional thing? But in that tradition of Dzogchen, they're always combined. It's called preliminaries, but Sogni Rinpoche says he feels like for modern America that actually it's a different culture now. Maybe we don't naturally have that kind of devotion. So he thinks it's good first really point out this nature of mind, receive teachings, understand and practice this like dropping off zazen, basically, or Dzogchen meditation. Kind of emphasize that first, and then we have some kind of flavor for that deep relaxation and ease, then start doing this difficult practice that was originally called preliminaries, but then, you know, you're to kind of go with this non-doing kind of practice. And the example he used, which I thought was quite nice, is it's like we, you know, when we're sitting zazen, we can get really relaxed and have a really spacious, open mind. And then it's harder to bring that into daily life, to have that kind of permeate our sort of relative world. So if our, you know, the habitual obscurations of mind are like a piece of paper, and the this non-dual Buddha nature mind is trying to like, is like your finger trying to poke through a paper, it's kind of hard to get through there. You can do it with some effort, and over time you can wear the paper away. But if you, with these types of devotional practices, like refuge and bodhicitta, and also repentance practice, called Vajrasattva practice in Tibetan Buddhism, and mandala offerings, which is a generosity practice, and guru yoga, which is devotional practice to your teachers. All of these so-called preliminary practices are like moisture. So he took a piece of paper and started sprinkling water on it, and they open us up. They open up this kind of relative, obscurations of the habitual mind. They moisten that. So then, when the paper is quite moist, you can just, your finger goes right through. The finger of this kind of easeful, open meditation mind can kind of permeate the relative experience of daily life more easily when moistened by these conventional surrender, openness, repentance, generosity types of practices. Yeah. So again, in Zen, I think we have our daily services include refuge, repentance. When we do the Bodhisattva vows, it's the Bodhicitta practice, and we make offerings. It's like a mandala offering. So I think we have almost all these same elements in Zen, but they're more implicit, and we maybe don't do them 100,000 times. Eventually, maybe we do. It adds up. Somebody, I remember talking, somebody at Zen Center talking about these Tibetan 100,000 practices. All these practices are done 100,000 times, not just the prostrations. And somebody said, well, when you're sewing Buddha's robe, like this kind of robe, I don't know if anyone ever counted the stitches, but you take refuge in Buddha with each stitch, like a rakasu or okesa. And there's at least hundreds, if not thousands, of stitches, right? So I think that's an example of, we do that before the ceremony of taking refuge in Buddha, receiving the precepts. We kind of do this preliminary thing of taking refuge over and over with stitches like that. So we have those types of elements. And I think maybe those who've sewn rakasus and okesas can testify that it maybe moistened you up a little bit for the ceremony. Yeah. Also, it was mentioned that Zen doesn't have so many stages. So this is an example of, you have like preliminary practices, and then you get these, you know, subtle body practices, and then you get these nature of mind practices. And Zen, it's just like right from the start, you say, just wholeheartedly sit. Maybe there's a natural evolution, but it's not specific stages. Except Roshi Joan, the one thing she mentioned in Zen is we have the five ranks. So we just had this class series on that. She said, well, you know, that's maybe about it in Zen, with the five ranks, which sometimes isn't even seen as stages. But so maybe the 10 Oxfording pictures is more Rinzai Zen teaching, but could be seen as stages of practice. But it's not emphasized. There's just, she said Zen is kind of like, you're just like immediately just thrown into the pond and asked to swim without having learned how first. That's the kind of Zen style, traditionally. And I think we still have that a little bit. We don't have so many, like, here's all the stages you go through first before you do meditation. And maybe kind of works. You eventually, if you stick with it, maybe take some devotion or stubbornness, you kind of start learning how to swim slowly. It's okay if you get a little wet and have to cough up some water. Another thing that was mentioned is, I think that Sophie Rinpoche said, from his understanding of Zen, looking a little bit at Dogen and talking with his Zen friends, he feels like Zen is really, really almost more radical than the Dzogchen. They're both seen as non-dual teachings. And, you know, you can't really have more or less in the realm of non-duality. Right? But the example he brought up is that around the two truths, which we've also been looking at in this five ranks class, the relationship of the two truths, meaning the relative truth, the conventional truth of appearances, and the ultimate truth of no appearance and non-arising and no reference points anywhere. Buddhism, and particularly Mahayana Buddhism, is very important teaching, is the relationship of these two truths and how they go together. They always go together. But Rinpoche says that his understanding is, in Zen, it's like the relative is the ultimate, period. That's how radical it is. Whereas in the Dzogchen teachings, it's often said more like the relative and the ultimate are non-dual, but we can also say that the relative is kind of like the obscurations to the ultimate that need to be seen through. Like the sentient being, even though the sentient being's nature is Buddha nature, the sentient being is confused obscuration. Whereas in Zen, I think we can find these kind of teachings in Dogen. It goes a little bit further to say that the sentient being, even if we call it an obscuration to Buddha nature, is already perfectly manifested Buddha. Now again, I can think of teachings in both traditions that say that same thing, and teachings in both traditions that make it seem a little bit like you have to work on this. Like Suzuki Roshi's really wonderful phrase, you're perfect just as you are, and yet you could also use some improvement. Yeah. So that's a little bit maybe more like he was saying the Tibetan tradition. It's like, you're perfect as you are, but there's also something to work on here. Whereas to say the relative truth is the ultimate truth completely, it's like there's nothing to work on at all. And this may be connected with this fact that the classical Zen teachings don't emphasize like the training in kind of kindness and compassion so much, because it's just so ultimate. It's like, why do anything at all? So again, I think we remedy this in modern American Zen, because as you know, it can be problematic if you just say you don't need any improvement. But I thought that was interesting that Rinpoche said Zen goes as far as saying the relative is the ultimate. He said within the Tibetan tradition, there's an ongoing debate for many, many centuries on the subtle difference of whether the relative is the ultimate or the relative is slightly obscuring the ultimate. So it's not even clear cut in that tradition. And sometimes it's just the way we talk about it can make it sound different. Also, Zen uses koans to point out the nature of mind. There's a Dzogchen tradition of when the student's ready, the teacher, in the right context, points out the nature of mind directly. And it could be using like words or no words. So I think it's quite similar to Zen in some ways, but they don't have these stories, these teaching stories that are the heart of the Zen literature, the koans. So that in a way, maybe all koans are actually pointing out instructions, maybe we could say. But Roshi Joan brought up a couple of just, I don't know why she chose these, but she said, I thought these were wonderful stories though. On his 98th case in the Book of Serenity, a monk comes to Dungshan and says, of the three Buddha bodies, the Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Nirmanakaya, maybe she brought this out because that's the kind of thing that Tibetans talk about, these classifications. Of these three Buddha bodies, which one does not fall into any category? The monk asked Dungshan that. And Dungshan replied, I am always intimate with it. Or I am always intimate with this. That's a direct pointing that cuts through the mind that wants to categorize things. I'm always intimate with that, which doesn't fall into any categories. But I'm not going to tell you which Buddha body it is, because that's kind of categorical. And then she mentioned, she brought up one of my favorite Zen koans that in the Lumon Khan about the it's like you're hanging from a tree by your mouth. You know this story? You're hanging from a tree by your mouth and your hands and feet can't grasp any branch. And underneath you, somebody comes along and says, what's the meaning of Bodhidharma is coming from the West? Which is the old Zen way of saying, what's the true meaning of Zen? Like, give it to me straight. So, you know, you're, as a Bodhisattva, if you don't answer, you're neglecting your responsibility to help this person by giving them some Dharma. But if you answer, you'll lose your life falling from this tree. So, what do you do? And I thought this was a great example of Rinpoche's sense of humor. She turned to him and said, what would you do, Rinpoche? And he said, I would text them. That's pretty good. Text them the answer. Also, Tibetan tradition, because it doesn't have any stages, I mean, because it does have some stages, it's willing to talk about stages, even though it's beyond all of them. It's willing to make some distinctions. That's one of the reasons that I've personally been drawn to it over these last years, is the Dzogchen tradition in particular is very, very skillful, I feel like, at pointing out subtle distinctions in what the meditation practice is. I think Zen is not so good at this, traditionally. And I think it's intentionally not so good at this, because it just throws you in the pond, you know. It just learn how to swim by swimming, so it doesn't set up these subtle distinctions. But I think, for me, I find it's quite helpful. So one distinction is that tradition calls calm abiding meditation, settling into the present moment without any particular support. Like a support would be like an object, like the breath. So there's also calm abiding, using the breath as an object to keep coming back to the present by using the breath or the body posture. Those are like supports, very good for learning this calm abiding and staying really grounded. But there's also, if we're quite calm already, we can let go of the support. And so without any particular object, just be present. And this is called calm abiding without support. It's not called the nature of mind, resting in the nature of mind, or pure awareness. That's the pinnacle of the Dzogchen teachings. So this is an example of one of these subtle distinctions. Because often when, we'll just practice calm abiding in the present moment with no particular object. People say, isn't that Shikantaza, the pinnacle of Zen? And this is an example I would say, not exactly, very, very close. And in that tradition, they also say very, very close. But the difference is that there's some slight sense of duality, like there's still like a sense of now. This is quite subtle duality, like now as opposed to the past or future. Now is still a subtle object of experience, the present moment. Whereas in this pure awareness of the nature of mind, there's not even the present moment. It's beyond the three times, it said. So subtle, but, you know, it's nice to note the distinctions. And also there's a little bit of effort, like mindfulness practice to stay on the present is a quality of this calm abiding, whereas this non-dual spacious awareness of the nature of mind is completely effortless. It's reached through effort. Like Suzuki Roshi says, we have to make effort right up to the point where all effort disappears. And also it's very, this non-dual nature of mind, very, very spacious, and there's no boundaries, where there still might be a little bit, this we're talking about quite subtle sense of boundedness or space when we're just in the present moment. And whereas this resting in the nature of mind, one example, metaphor that Rinpoche uses, he comes up with lots of strange images as metaphors. It's like being in an unfriendly bathroom. I was like, huh? So he calls it, an unfriendly bathroom is like a bathroom where you go in and there's no hooks on the wall for your clothes. So you start getting undressed, but you notice there's no place to put anything. So you just have to drop it on the floor. So this, you know, resting in the spacious expanse of the nature of mind is like being in an unfriendly bathroom where you're shedding all your stuff and you have no hooks to put anything on. That's what you mean by no reference points. There's no place to hang even the slightest thing. It's just drop off body and mind, yeah, onto the floor and then step naked into the shower and don't even care where your clothes land. Yeah. He says there's some good kind of mantras to use for like entering this kind of practice. Like modern kind of mantras, like just do it. These I think are great for Zen practice too. Just do it. He says like Nike says. And whatever happens, just let it happen. You know, we hear this kind of teaching too, but I think to really take these up is wonderful. In meditation and daily life, just do it. Whatever happens, just let it happen. Whatever doesn't happen, just let it not happen. This would be like if you're kind of expecting some result from meditation. When am I going to get, like, when is the great bliss going to come? Whatever doesn't happen, just let it not happen. And just say, so what? Or who cares? It's one of his big teachings recently. And I think this doesn't mean like, if somebody's suffering in front of you, you don't say, so what, or who cares? But referring to your own meditation practice at this deeper level is the practice of saying, so what, who cares? Oh, this period, I just can't concentrate at all. You maybe know from experience, if you start thinking about it and obsessing about it, it just builds up more and more. But if you can say, so what? I can't concentrate this period. Who cares? Actually, if you've ever tried this, immediately there's some presence and relaxation there. Who cares where this practice leads? So, that's some... some notes. It's a report from the front line of the mixing of Dzogchen and Zen in America for the first time. May it continue. But Sobni Rinpoche, by the way, is also, some years ago, he co-led a retreat with Ajahn Amaro in the Theravada tradition, Thai forest tradition, Dzogchen and the Thai forest meditations, where also you can find very similar spacious mind meditation even in the Theravada. So this is the beauty of practicing Buddhism in America. Wide roof. Do you have any questions or comments? Yes. Richard. Yeah.
And I'm at first I recoil, you know, because, and then you declarify by saying, well, that's just, that's not in response to suffering, but it's only internal. But I thought about externalizing it by saying, what happens, you let happen, and you also let your response happen.
Yes. Yep. That's right. Yeah. So if we say, to say, whatever happens, just let it happen, and we see, like, you know, the, you know, a big jar of milk spill on the floor, right? Instead of just saying, oh, yeah, whatever, we can actually go and clean it up, you know, and that's part of letting what happens happen. It doesn't mean, like, don't do anything at all. I mean, if you apply it to sitting meditation, formal meditation practice, then it might literally mean don't move and don't do anything and don't, like, react and don't let the mind, get all agitated about whatever's happening. Yeah, so also in regards to compassion, and, you know, we say at the beginning, there's this context of cultivating compassion. There's practices to do that. And in the end, these nature of mind teachings, my understanding from these traditions is that is so, then the natural, true compassion, just selflessness, spacious responsiveness, naturally just arises from that. So that's, in a way, the purpose of all this. We start with intentional cultivation of compassion, and we end with a natural flowing forth of benefiting all beings. We could even say that's the point. Of course, it's liberation for the practitioner also, but our bodhisattva vow is that this is all just for all, freeing all beings. And one point that Rinpoche mentioned too was, maybe in response to a question, is, well, if our motivation's not totally pure, like we're not completely sincere, and this means, in Buddhist language, means the small self is like trying to get something for itself in whatever we're doing. Totally sincere, pure motivation is just like selfless. Like if you're practicing giving, but you're like, because you hope to get something back, then you could say that's not completely sincere. He said, if in practices regarding your own personal practice, like your meditation, then we should actually really work on and not even do them. He might even gone so far as to say not even do them unless the motivation's sincere. I think maybe for meditation we could say, if we're trying to like get something for ourselves in zazen, then it won't even work. So don't even bother. Or as you said, practices that you're doing for others, it doesn't matter if your motivation is sincere, if it's pure, if you're trying to get something for yourself, just do it anyway. I thought that was a good teaching. If it's for your own kind of meditation practice, you don't even bother unless you can just let go of yourself. Maybe that's too strict, I don't know. But you could say, well, just it's a moment-to-moment thing. You could be doing it with some self and just don't continue without letting go of yourself. Maybe that's a strong teaching, but that's a good one. But for, you know, well, maybe I shouldn't give this gift unless I really don't want anything back. He says, no, just give it, actually. In that case, it's going to benefit. And even the slightest benefit to others, it doesn't matter how pure you are in practicing it. Yeah. Yes?
Was there any discussion of, in regard to giving to others, of tonglen practice?
Not in this short weekend retreat, but Sogni Rinpoche at other retreats, Do you all know the practice of Tonglen? This is a nice classic Tibetan practice. It means in Tibetan giving and receiving, and it's using the breath, so you're settling into the breath, but it's a visualization or an imagination. That is, you're breathing in the pain of all beings. You can do it with one particular person who's really suffering, someone close to you who's suffering. You can do it with all beings. The suffering of the world, you breathe it in the form of black smoke, and you're willing to take that in. So that's like training your mind and being that open to take on suffering for others. It's just an imagination, but it's training your mind. And you breathe out pure, like, light out to those people. So you're like a, like an air purifier. You're like breathing in the dirt and breathing out the good, which is usually, often it's the opposite. It's our natural tendency is to try to breathe in the good and breathe out the not so good. Doesn't matter so much. You know, those people breathe my exhaust. So it's reversing. It's a mind training to reverse our usual tendency. So that's Tonglen. And Sogdi Rinpoche says, if I can remember right, somebody asked him about this, and he's like, I don't teach this so much because I respect the practice of Tonglen so much that I think it usually gets distorted. And my understanding of true Tonglen is it doesn't make you feel good. It actually makes you suffer. It's training in suffering, intentionally being willing to suffer. And that's what compassion really is. He has said too, is that you're really willing to suffer for others. Whereas people like to do Tonglen in this way that's a little bit askew, where they actually start feeling good, like, oh, I feel so compassionate and, you know, purified doing this, even though I'm taking in the smoke, like, I feel really exalted and light. And, you know, I think he even says, in the end, it can be that way. When you really become quite selfless, but he says, if we're doing it with the motivation to feel good ourselves, then it's not really Tonglen, don't even bother. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like the previous comment, right? Mm-hmm. If you're doing this Tonglen to develop your compassion for others, or for your own development, mm-hmm. then if it's not with this pure motivation, then you know, let's not even talk about it. He's kind of strict in many ways, but I appreciate that. Yes.
In that practice, I know it's not what you're focusing on right now, but in that practice, is it possible for someone that's not to be ready to do that, to take on that kind of...
Mm. Yeah, well, in a way, to do it as a visualization practice, the nice part, this is part of the vast array of skillful means in the Tibetan tradition. Zen has many skillful means too. Upaya Zen Center. Upaya means skillful means, right? I think as a skillful means practice for ourself, I think one could start doing that, and because you're not really the black smoke is not real, right? So I think if you're doing it as just a practice, you can see where, oh, I have some resistance to it. I really don't like doing it. And the more sincerely I do it and the more fully I'm visualizing it, the harder it is to do. But then we get to see our mind like this. So I don't think they would ever say, don't do it because you'll cause yourself too much pain. I think with Tonglen, maybe if you don't understand the bigger context of the motivation, and we don't have teachings about no abiding self, maybe without that context, then maybe we could get really dark and stuck.
The idea of myself, or if not, because just reading recently, Suzuki Roshi was saying in the term of the Heart Sutra, it says, form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. So you can actually get caught in duality in that concept there.
Mm-hmm.
Because fortunately, our practice takes it a step further to say form is form and emptiness is emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
So with that twist of thought in there of it not being real, or not, of it
being empty,
it's
Yeah, all those and all those practices, all the relative practices in these Tibetan traditions are ideally unified more and more with the ultimate truth that all of it's empty. So like, that's why this modern teacher, Sogni Rinpoche, says, first, I think it's good for people to have some understanding and some realization of the nature of mind. In other words, emptiness, the empty nature of mind, before doing this struggle of 100,000 prostrations, or else it's just a bunch of hard work. Like, but if you keep unifying it with like, this is just like a dream, but we're still going to do it and we're sweating away, but it's dream exhaustion, then it's when it really starts working, and you don't fall into the side of, well, since this is empty and it's all the same, let's just stop. And you keep 100,000, 99,000 more. but you keep unifying it with the true truths being unified is when it really works. Because the Tibetans are devoted enough that they don't have to understand emptiness, they can just do 100,000 prostrations. But in America, we don't have that kind of thing. So first you have to realize that your bowels are empty and your discomfort is empty. And then you can really start getting into it. So I think that would apply to like the Tonglen thing too. Yeah. You know, maybe not fully realize how it's all empty, but even just a little bit. The way is perfect and all pervading, like vast space with nothing lacking and nothing extra. Indeed, it is just due to our choosing or rejecting that we do not see thus. May all beings drop off body and mind and live for the benefit of all beings. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them.